This week, we consider 2 Samuel 14, in which Absalom returned to David's court. We are knee-deep in the narrative of Absalom's rebellion. The story arc started two messages ago in 2 Samuel 13, so if you haven't listened to those preceding messages, you might want to go back and listen, but we will give a brief recap. Herein, Absalom, the son of King David, had been living in hiding and banishment in Geshur after having murdered his brother Amnon. But Absalom had a supporter in Joab, David's military commander, who lobbied for Absalom's restoration. In today's passage, then, we read of how Joab sent a woman to David's court to trick him into allowing Absalom to return. Absalom did return to Jerusalem, but I'm not sure Joab or anyone was better off for it. After two more years of being banned from entering David's court, Absalom found a creative way to get Joab to push for his full inclusion, which ultimately occurred. Your passage for consideration, then, is 2 Samuel 14, and if you haven't read it yet, I recommend that you pause and read it now. Previously in 2 Samuel, King David committed adultery with Bathsheba and had her husband Uriah the Hittite killed to cover it up. Nathan the prophet told David that he would suffer consequences from this, primarily in that trouble would come from his own household. Not long thereafter, David's firstborn son, Crown Prince Amnon, raped his half-sister Tamar. 2 years later, her brother Absalom, David's third son, murdered Amnon in response and then fled to Geshur, where he stayed with his maternal grandfather, King Talmai, for 3 years. David wanted Absalom back in Jerusalem, and we can understand why. Absalom was David's son, and a good father loves his sons even when they do wrong. He had already lost one son in Amnon. It was not good to lose two. Not only that, but Absalom's crime, that of having murdered his brother Amnon, had been as much a process crime as anything. Amnon had deserved to be banished at the least, and while Absalom had acted wrongly by killing him, his cause was at least a sympathetic one, his primary error having been that he didn't receive a judgment to go and do it. That said, bringing Absalom home would have been ethically and politically thorny. Absalom's crime warranted a penalty of death. As long as Absalom was out of sight, David could justify both to himself and to the people around him his leaving Absalom alive. However, summoning Absalom back to the king's court would have been a bad look. It's hard to respect the king when he keeps murderers hanging around, and even more so when the person murdered had been the crown prince. But David's military commander Joab knew that David wanted Absalom back, and so he devised a plan to bring him back. I'm curious about what Joab's motivations were. Did he just see the king emotionally tormenting himself, being torn between two options and choosing the one that made him unhappy, such that Joab wanted to help David resolve that dilemma? Or maybe Joab wanted Absalom back himself. We recall that Joab was David's nephew. Joab was probably significantly older than his cousin Absalom, but maybe the two had a close relationship, so that Absalom wanted to see him return. Or maybe Joab just wanted looser standards against murderers. Joab had been a murderer himself. Maybe he had despised Amnon for sexual immorality. That was not his particular brand of sin. Joab decided then to trick David using Nathan the prophet's old "you are the man" trick. In chapter 12, Nathan had tricked David into pronouncing judgment against himself by presenting a case to him which paralleled his own actions, and then turning the tables on him by declaring, "you are the man." Here, Joab would do the same. He found an old woman and told her to tell David that her son had killed his brother and faced the death penalty, and to then plea for his life to be spared. When David spared her son, she would ask why David had then not spared his own son. And so Joab found a woman and convinced her to go before David. She dressed and acted as if she was in mourning for her dead son, and she bowed down before the king. When he asked that she make her case, she told Joab's tale. She said that one of her sons had killed the other in an argument and that she was a widow. Being a widow was significant because she had no path to having any other sons, and the widow's sons were the widow's providers. If this only son was to die, then she would have no one to care for her, and not only that, but her dead husband's name would vanish. Her request, then, was that in honor of her dead husband and to ensure her provision, the murdering son should be spared his life. The fact that she got away with telling this story causes me to pause and ask just how loose David's court was. At a glance, it appears that a person could just walk into David's court and brazenly commit perjury without any penalty. It also appears that people could appeal cases to David's court without adequate documentation of decisions from lower courts, And it seems that in a case like this, a lower court would have to have ruled against her son before she could bring an appeal to David. Not only did she seemingly have no documentation, but she also seemingly had no evidence of anything she was saying. The son apparently was not there, and the locals who supposedly wanted the man put to death had no representative that we read of. From what we read here, the case seems a total mess. Nothing like this could ever fly in a modern courtroom. But then I also come to the passage with the presumption that the widow's story isn't fundamentally true. I presume that because the passage starts with Joab's perspective and tells us that he found the woman and told her what to say. But then, when we consider it, we could conclude that what the woman said actually was the truth. Perhaps Joab set out to find a woman whose case matched his set of facts and was successful at finding one. If that was what happened, then he still could have told her how to present her case, and she could have shown up with all the proper paperwork. Just because the passage doesn't mention arguments from the opposing side doesn't mean that there were none. I kind of doubt all of that, though. I think it took many years to really develop a tightly functioning system of laws, and that things were probably just looser in David's time. I've said it before, and I will say it again. David was a better warrior than a lawyer. He wasn't making legal decisions because he graduated from law school, passed the bar, and got elected to the bench. He was making legal decisions because he was the strong man who could win the wars and enforce obedience to his will. That doesn't mean David was a bad ruler. It just means that he was what he was. I also think that the comparison between the widow's case and David's case is a little flimsy in that there is a significant factual difference. The widow was a widow. She needed her son to care for her. He was also her only son and heir to her husband's estate. If he died, then the memory of her husband and everything that she had would be gone. The case of David and Absalom is not at all like that. David was a king, and he had many sons. The reason for forgiving the widow's son here is not really at all like the reason for forgiving Absalom. Regardless, poor a trap as it was, this was the trap that Joab set, and ultimately it was effective, probably more for emotional reasons than for factual ones. In verses 8 through 11, we read that David gave his decision. Interestingly, it seems that the widow had to press David to make the decision. In verse 8, David simply told the woman to go home and he would give orders concerning her. That doesn't really tell her whether he would side with her or not. The widow, perhaps sensing that David would not side with her, declared that the guilt of his decision to leave a murderer alive should rest with her and not with him. That seems like a particularly bad argument since it tacitly acknowledges that a decision in her favor was the wrong one. But perhaps it was convincing to David in that it took the burden off of his shoulders. The argument also suggested just how desperate her cause was. After that, David indicated that he would side with her, at least inasmuch as that she would be protected, whether or not her son would. He said that if anyone gave her, personally, any trouble, then that person would have to answer to him. The widow persisted, though, insisting that she would only be satisfied if David would swear in Jehovah's name that no avenger would be allowed to kill her son. Finally, after the third round of goading, David swore in the name of Jehovah that her son would not be harmed, using the euphemism that not one hair of his head would fall to the ground. David's decision in the widow's case was, in my opinion, clearly out of line with the law. The law of Moses prescribes a death penalty for murder. It inherited this tradition from God's covenant with Noah all the way back in Genesis chapter 9. I don't see any exception in the law to keep a murderer alive if he's the only surviving son of a widow. If such an exception did exist, then I would suppose lots of people would get away with murder, particularly if they murdered their own brothers. Neither the desire to keep the family's heritage going for another generation nor the desire of the widow to have the provision of her son outweighs the need to restrain murder. I would think that if we were to compile a list of laws in order of priority, punishing murder would be at or near the very top, and keeping the family name alive would be at the bottom. But then, he was a better warrior than a lawyer. More often than not, the decisions coming out of his court were not the ones I would have made. The point, though, was this. For better or worse, David had decided that the pleasure of the parent in keeping the child was better than punishing the child, even for murder. And that, at least in some sense, would show a contradiction in his strained relationship with Absalom. The widow, being ever so courteous before the king, asked to speak a word and, having his permission, pointed out the contradiction. The king, she said, had convicted himself by not bringing Absalom home. Having said this, the woman rambled on through verses 14 through 17. She first compared life to water spilled on the ground. As water cannot be gathered up again with the hand, so the passing of life cannot be reversed. We all die. However, the woman asserted that death and banishment from the presence of God are not his desire, and thus he makes a way for people to return to him. This, I suppose, was intended to make David see how brief his life and his relationship to his son Absalom would be, that he would value it more, and was to compare his act of forgiving Absalom to God's forgiving character. Next, the woman addressed her motivations for speaking in verses 15 through 16. In those verses, she stuck to her story about her son being threatened with death. This leads me to believe that perhaps she had been telling the truth all along, but who knows. She then suggested that David's decision would be sufficient to fix her problem and flattered the king as a man of supernatural wisdom, calling on Jehovah to bless him. Having heard the woman's word pertaining to his relationship with Absalom, David made an educated guess that Joab had been behind it all, and she, amid much flattery about David's wisdom for having guessed correctly, admitted that this was indeed Joab's attempt to change the king's mind. David responded by telling Joab to go and fetch Absalom. Joab, also observing courtly courtesies, bowed down and thanked David for having shown him favor. And so Joab went to fetch Absalom. When Absalom arrived in Jerusalem, David sent him to live in another house, but did not allow him to come into the king's presence. David had granted the request to bring Absalom back, but it is understandable that he was still uncomfortable having him in the king's court. Absalom had murdered David's firstborn son, the crown prince. Much as David may have loved Absalom, he couldn't just act like that kind of behavior was acceptable. And then, briefly departing from the narrative, verses 25 through 27 give us a description of Absalom himself. Verse 25 describes him as having been the most handsome man in Israel. The passage supports this assertion by noting that his skin was of a remarkably smooth consistency, such that he had no blemishes whatsoever. Apparently part of his beauty was his hair, which grew exceptionally thick and which he kept long. I guess that was considered to be a good look for a young man at the time. Don't forget Absalom's thick hair. It will be important later. But just how thick the hair was is a curiosity. The passage tells us that Absalom's hair was cut annually, and when it was cut, it weighed 200 shekels. And that is something to consider. I trust the measurement. The scribe who wrote this even accounted for the weight that was used. However, the amount of hair seems to be impossibly excessive. Using the conversion provided to us by the English Standard Version, that a shekel weighs about 2/5 of an ounce, we can do a little math and find that his hair weighed 5 pounds, or about 0.45 kilos. That's some heavy hair. I wanted to find out just how much hair it would take to equal 5 pounds, so I had a local hair salon save some clippings for me. They kept them in a box, so I was able to get a reasonably accurate measure of the volume, and then I transferred the hair to a plastic garbage bag and weighed it. I did a little more math and determined that to get 5 pounds of hair, I would have needed 19.98 gallons, or 75.63 liters of hair clippings. For some reference, one of those large black trash bags might hold about 30 gallons. So 2/3 of a giant trash can would be about how much hair Absalom was growing per year. If the measurements and the conversions we have are accurate, then Absalom's hair growth was wildly outside the norm. The average person's hair grows something like 4 to 6 inches, 10 to 15 centimeters per year. I didn't think far enough ahead to take any measurements, so I'm not sure of what kind of volume that hair and beard would be, but making an educated guess, I can't imagine it would fill a gallon jug. My supposition then is that either Absalom grew as much hair as 20 normal men, and it is hard to see how that could possibly be attractive, or that something is seriously wrong with the measurements here. Part of the problem might be hair product. John Gill, biblical commentator from the 1700s, guessed that Absalom's hair might have been excessively heavy because it was weighted down with oils. It is well known that the ancients would treat their hair with oil, and in fact, today's passage mentions that to fail to anoint oneself with oil was a sign of mourning. Josephus, in his Antiquities of the Jews, gave us another interesting tidbit about ancient hair care, though it seems so excessive I have a hard time believing him. He wrote that in the days of Solomon, the men would sprinkle their hair with gold dust so that it would glitter in the sunlight. The point, though, is that Absalom's hair was probably not just hair. It was probably also hair mixed with something much denser than hair. We might also guess that the conversion between the king's shekel and the modern ounce here provided in the ESV is not accurate. I would guess that the weights could have been lighter than they were. And, as always, we note that the number might just be a slip of the scribal pen. numbers are the thing that are hardest to transmit faithfully. And there are instances where the numbers are incorrect in the scriptures that we know of. So maybe this just wasn't supposed to be 200. Whatever the truth of the matter is, we know that Absalom must have had excessively long, thick, and dense hair, so much so that he felt the need to have it weighed, and the author of the passage felt the need to note for us just how heavy it was. People at the time noticed this, and it was a world record sort of hair, so they left a record for us to remember it by. More important than the specifics of the weight of the hair is what his hair tells us about him. First, we find here that Absalom was a man of no shame. 1 Corinthians 11 tells us that nature itself says that long hair shames a man. Men ought not to be overly concerned with their looks, and particularly not overly proud with growing out long hair as a fashion statement. A man, particularly at that time, and particularly a king's son, ought to have been concerned with fitness for battle and utility at work, and long hair could be a hindrance to those things. Absalom was a man of shameful vanity and idleness. He had been born into the lap of luxury, son of a king and of a princess. He had never known hard work that would tan or scar the skin. He had never needed to cut his hair to march into battle or to stay fit for work in the fields. He was the type to sit at home and style his hair in an attempt to show himself better than everyone else, and he was so insistent on this that he actually had people weigh his hair so that he could show that off. Absalom wasn't exactly an exemplary character in this regard. The passage also notes that Absalom had 4 children, 3 sons, whose names are not noteworthy, and a daughter named Tamar. No doubt she was named for Absalom's sister. We don't know whether this daughter was born before the rape of Tamar or after. At the least, her name represents to us how much Absalom loved his sister, which helps to explain why he had killed Amnon. If this daughter was born after the murder of Amnon, we might take it that the name of Absalom's daughter demonstrates to us that Absalom was fully committed to the murder. Rather than conceding that he had done the wrong thing, he appears to have named his daughter as a reminder to everyone of what he had done and why. We don't know for certain when she was born, though. This Tamar, the passage notes for us, was a beautiful woman. We don't know, though, if she was already old enough to be counted as a woman at the time of these events. More likely, she was described that way in retrospect after the events currently in question had taken place. It had been 7 years since the rape of Tamar. Chapter 13 told us that Absalom waited 2 years after that to kill Amnon and that he lived in hiding for 3 years thereafter. Per verse 28 of today's chapter, 2 more years passed in which Absalom lived in Jerusalem before he stood before David. But Absalom, who evidently had become accustomed to all of the comforts and powers of courtly life in Geshur, wasn't happy in Jerusalem. He was living in his own house like a commoner. He was probably given fewer provisions than he might have had before in Geshur, and he was probably bored. Absalom would settle for nothing less than full acceptance back into David's household, and so he sent for Joab in hopes of having him lobby again on his behalf. He sent for Joab twice, but Joab wouldn't come. Absalom was not the kind of person who would tolerate being ignored, and so he decided to get Joab's attention in a very negative way. He ordered his servants, who displayed a shocking amount of loyalty, to go and burn Joab's barley field. Burning someone's crops is a serious crime. Those crops are food, and food is both money and life. Exodus 22:6 required that if a fire broke out and destroyed crops, the one who started it would be required to pay a full restitution. When I read that passage, I get the impression that the intent was for a fire started by accident. It seems to me that arson might have, or probably should have, carried punitive damages, as, say, in the case of someone who intentionally stole. This was Absalom's wealth and entitlement on full display. He could get away with breaking the rules and not really worry about the cost, and he didn't really care about how much he inconvenienced others, because evidently he just viewed himself as being more important than them. Obviously, Joab could not ignore Absalom's servants starting fires in his fields, and so he went to Absalom. How Absalom may have responded concerning the fire is unclear. I'm sure he paid Joab back for it, because if he didn't, I have serious doubts that Joab would have helped him with anything. But when Joab arrived, Absalom insisted that Joab should approach the king for him. Absalom said life had been better in Geshur, and if David didn't want to welcome him back into the court, that he should just kill him already. Absalom was obviously spoiled rotten. He would have preferred to die than to lounge in his own house with enough wealth and privilege to light crops on fire. Amazingly, Joab actually followed through on Absalom's request. It is surprising that Joab would be willing to push so hard for someone who would brazenly light his fields on fire. It makes me wonder if Absalom had something hanging over Joab's head to blackmail him. Whatever his motivation was, though, Joab went to the king, and finally David called Absalom in. Absalom bowed down, and David kissed him. It was a sign of acceptance. He would not put Absalom to death. To conclude, this week we've considered a chunk of narrative in which Joab played a trick on David to convince him to bring Absalom back from his banishment for having murdered Amnon. The trick worked. David made another bad legal decision, and Absalom returned to Jerusalem. The passage depicts Absalom in an unfavorable way. He was good-looking, but not a man of good character. Absalom was born of royalty on both sides and was accustomed to the comforts of courtly life. The evidence suggests that he was unduly wealthy, overly concerned with his looks, self-centered, demanding, and spoiled. Absalom is the archetypical wealthy brat. He set Joab's field on fire to get his attention and demanded that he be brought back to David's court. David finally acquiesced. It would be a big problem.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.